Okay, we are going to go ahead and get started. Can y'all hear me all right? Is that volume good? Okay. Hello and welcome to our second Theology Night session on C.S. Lewis. So last week we heard Kimball speak on his own experience reading Lewis, as well as some background and thematic threads to Lewis's book Mere Christianity. And then tonight we're going to explore further the role of the imagination in Lewis's work. And we're also going to turn to his book, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, which is one of the volumes in the Chronicles of Narnia series, if you're not already aware of that. And then also, by the way, I'm working with Sister Teresa on getting recordings for all of these sessions. So I'm going to make those accessible to you. So stay tuned. I'll either send those out on the email list or I'll put them on the website, but I'll keep you guys posted on whatever we end up doing with that. That way you can... If you miss a session, you can go back and listen, or if you want to share with others, you can pass it along to them. But before we get into our evening, before we welcome up Kimball, let's take a moment to bless our evening together with a prayer that God would ignite our imaginations, much as he did C.S. Lewis's. So... Okay, so let's all pray together. Creator of the universe, how infinite and astonishing are you. How divine and Son and of the Holy Spirit. Okay, let's welcome up Kimball.
So thank you, Zach. Can you all hear me okay? We're going to pick up where we left off last time. If you remember last time, we introduced Mere Christianity and the strange theme that we know that there is a law of human nature and we break it. And tonight we're going to move a little bit beyond talking about that idea as an idea into exploring that idea, looking along the beam, if you remember that difference between looking at something and looking along it, being involved in it, actually making it a part of your life. That's what we're going to be doing tonight, exploring that mystery through imaginative literature as opposed to education or some sort of science or objective analysis. We're just going to deal with stories, and we're going to be searching for truth in the midst of those stories. Lewis was an evangelist. He was a professor, but he loved stories. He loved telling stories and felt that there is a truth in the story that you feel in your heart more than you do in your mind, and that you can reach the heart through the story more than through expository analysis or prose or thinking. So we're going to look along that beam tonight. The Bible is a true story. It's the story of life. It's the source of wisdom. The word in the Bible is at the beginning. Remember the Gospel of John. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And all things were created in that beginning and through that Word. How do we know these things are true? Well, we know in part because we know the Bible and this story is the inspired Word of God. We know that the Bible is divided into, it's a whole collection of books. And it's divided into primarily a New Testament and an Old Testament. The New Testament is kind of subdivided into the synoptic gospels that tell the story of Jesus' life on earth. And then the Gospel of John, which explains what it all means. And then we have the Acts of the Apostles, where the church moves out through the gift of the Holy Spirit through the earth. And we have the letters and the epistles explaining how all of that works in our culture, and ultimately the book of Revelation and the future exposition of things that are fantastical and hard to imagine. It's almost a type of imaginative literature when you think about it. The Old Testament, of course, is the foundation for the New Testament. It explains the New Testament. It predicts the New Testament. There are prophetic stories that are types that are similar to the story in the Synoptic Gospels. It's all connected. It's the story. It's a kind of history. It's his story, the story of God, the story of all of us. And as practicing Catholics, we know that there are seasons in that story. We're familiar with those seasons in our sacramental worship. We're in the season of Lent now, where we're preparing ourselves for the Easter Triduum that's coming. We understand that all of this is a part of our sacramental experience and life together as Christians living out this Holy Spirit. Lewis was converted from atheism into a Christian and became one of the strongest, most popular apologists for Christian religion. He's reached out and touched more people with Christian stories, in large part by not being so overt about it. The stories are just wonderful stories, and we're going to be looking at one of the most Christian tonight. A part of our traditions as we go through Lent and approach the Easter Triduum is Good Friday. One of the things we do in the Liturgy of the Word on Good Friday is read the Passion of Christ. We do that again. We did it first on Palm Sunday. And then we do it again on Good Friday. The Passion of Christ is the crucible of the story. It's why it all happened. It's the part we celebrate at the sacrifice of the Mass, every time we come, where we become a part of that sacrifice. And the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, in that imaginative literature, we experience that story from a different perspective, in a different way, in a way that can touch us and reach us in our heart, in a way that might help us understand the real story of Jesus' life. Some people have said that The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe was an allegory. Well, Lewis said, no, it's not an allegory. An allegory is when, like Pilgrim's Progress, where Christian is a Christian and temptation is temptation. And that's not what The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe is. It's a story. It's a story. But it's a familiar story, especially to Christians. For those who aren't Christians, it's an introduction into Christianity because it's a story that lays out themes that are important aspects of our Christian experience together. Lewis reinvigorates our faith with this storytelling. In a way, he helps us discern the truth. But it's a discerning that requires us to become active in it ourselves. We can't just repeat in the liturgy words without really thinking about them. To have this experience really meaningful in our heart is to bring it into our heart and to in an active way. Part of the, how many have read The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe? And how many have read it recently? Okay, good. Just one.
Perfect.
Well, you're going to get to read it again because just the way we read the Passion on Palm Sunday and on Good Friday, I'm going to read part of the Passion part of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. So bear with me as we do that. Why is Aslan, who is Jesus, why is he a lion? Well, Lewis was British, the British lion. The lion's the king of beasts. It was a nice symbol, powerful symbol that he could use. The evil queen is beautiful but bloodless and ice cold. She has an ability with her wand to not only harden hearts, but to turn creatures and people into stones. The Pevensey children who travel from England into the world of Narnia are dedicated, normal kids who become royalty in this other world. There's a theme of temptation and betrayal, a giving in to evil that occurs that has the potential to destroy everything. And how does that evil get overcome to the ultimate good? There are many themes that play through this story. Before the fall comes temptation, the temptation that Edmund, one of the Pevensey children, falls to is first the temptation of pride, but then the temptation of Turkish delight. Why we have some Turkish delight back here tonight, in case, I don't know if you'll fall for it the same way Edmund did, but you have to remember that this was written during and after World War II. There were shortages. There was, in London, sugary treats were just not anything that you could get. And Edmund, it's interesting what Lewis says, that he was twisted by people in school. Lewis had some difficult experiences in his own schooling. And Edmund was kind of a beastly, arrogant, unhappy, selfish, prideful little boy. And through that pride and giving into that temptation where the queen offers to make him a prince if he'll do what she tells him, he becomes susceptible to, you think of the temptations that Satan gave to Jesus, that he would make him ruler of all of this if you just bow down before me. Well, that temptation is presented in Edmund. It doesn't say anything about Jesus, doesn't say anything about Satan, just talks about temptation, talks about pride. Evil exists in this world. It's personified in the wicked queen, but it's real, just as Satan is real. The Pevensey children move from England into Narnia through the wardrobe. Why is it the lion, the witch, and the wardrobe? Where did that title come from? I haven't read anything, but my thought is the lion is the king, is Jesus. The witch is Satan or evil. And the wardrobe made out of wood is the cross. We'll see next time in The Magician's Nephew how the wardrobe came to be made. It's linked to Narnia. It's from Narnia. And the children go through this wardrobe into that kingdom. Pick up your cross and follow me, we're told, through the wardrobe. Go through the wardrobe to find your way. That's how we gain access to our salvation. Peter, the eldest of the Pevensey children, and why is he Peter? Well, we've got St. Peter, and the keys are given to Peter. Maybe there's some other reason he was named Peter. I don't think so, even though Lewis was never Catholic. He might have been, but for the fact he came from Northern Ireland. But maybe we'll get to that in the fourth episode. But Peter has to fight the wolf. And he has to fight the wolf with the gifts that are given to him, just as we all need to. We all need to fight evil when we encounter it in our lives with the gifts that we have, not with someone else's gifts. This is a personal struggle that we have. He has to fight that fight with the gifts that he's given. The wicked queen herself has to be confronted. We can't run away from evil. We have to face up to evil. Her ultimate defeat is embedded in what she thinks is her triumph. It's only through death and resurrection and the sacrifice that the new life comes. Like the grain of wheat, you have to die to yourself to be born and 100-fold. Even Edmund, who I just described as such a wretched little child, turns out to be wonderful. He's the one who, in large part, helps save everyone and almost dies himself in doing so. Kind of like St. Dismas, the thief on the cross, who says to the other thief who's telling Jesus, why don't you just come down from this cross and save us and save yourself? And Dismas says, no, we're sentenced for what we did. Our sentence is justified. He's being crucified not having done anything. And ask Jesus to remember me when you come into your kingdom. And today you'll be with me in paradise. Even the evil, if we repent and confess our sins, can be saved. That theme is in this story. So we have a story of passion, resurrection, and redemption. And next time we'll talk about the prequel, The Magician's Nephew, which is the story of the creation of Narnia and how evil entered into that world. Lewis dedicated The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe to Lucy Barfield, the daughter of Owen Barfield, who was one of the Inklings. And Owen Barfield encouraged Lewis and because of that encouragement, in part, he loved Barfield's children. He got to know them well, and Barfield made them his grandparents. And the dedication in the book reads as follows. My dear Lucy, I wrote this story for you. But when I began it, I had not realized that girls grow quicker than books. As a result, you're already too old for fairy tales, and by the time it's printed and bound, you'll be older still. But someday, you'll be old enough to start reading fairy tales again. You can take them down from some upper shelf, dust it off, and tell me what you think of it. I'll probably be too deaf to hear and too old to understand a word you say, but I shall still be your affectionate godfather, C.S. Lewis. I think we could see the heart of the man in the very dedication of this story. So Lewis sets this story in real time, like the infant narrative in Luke that starts off with references to tax under Quirinius. This story opens in England as World War II is breaking out and the British children are being exiled out into the countryside to save them. For those of you who haven't read the story, I'll give you kind of a brief synopsis, kind of like when you go to a play, you get the little playbill that tells you the story. So there are four siblings, Peter, Susan, Edmund, and Lucy Pevensey, who were evacuated from London during the Second World War and sent to live with a professor in the English countryside. Actually, Lewis took some of those children and lived with him during his life. So this was an experience that he had. One day, Lucy discovers that one of the wardrobes in the house contains a door into another world. Soon after arriving there, she runs into a faun whose name is Tumnus, who takes her into his house and serves her some tea, and then tearfully confesses that he had sold his soul to the queen and was going to turn her in, but he can't do it, and he lets her go. She makes her way back through the wardrobe again, and no time has gone by. She tells her brothers and sisters what had happened, and they say she just made it all up, that none of that ever happened. And no, it's true. It really happened. And they just, look, stop. You know, okay, good joke, but enough. They go outside and play. The weather turns better. They go outside. It starts raining again. They come back inside. They're hiding. She goes back in again. Edmund follows her in there because he's really sort of curious as to, well, maybe it was true, even though he made fun of her for telling the story. She goes through. He goes through. She doesn't know he's following him. And he encounters the evil queen. And the queen then asks him what he is. And when she finds out that he's a boy, a son of Adam, there's a deep story and a deep wisdom that two sons of Adam and two daughters of Eve are going to sit in the thrones at Kaer Parvel and will rule over all of Narnia, which would mean the end of her reign. So she wants to be able to defeat that prophecy from coming to pass. And so she entrances Edmund with Turkish delight. She drops some magic in the snow and produces a foaming mug and then produces the candy. He eats 2 pounds of it. He wants more. She won't give him any more. Tells him she'll give him more if he goes back and brings his siblings with her. I want some more. No, you can't have any more, but you can have some more and you can be prince of my castle. See my castle over there? If you just do what I tell you. He goes back, but Lucy runs into him because they're both going by the lamppost on their way back. And, oh, Edmund, now you see that it's real. And he sort of, yeah, I do. And they go back in, but then he betrays her. He makes fun of her. He says, no, it's not true. It didn't really happen. And Lucy is just, she's the youngest child. She's just absolutely destroyed because nobody believes her. She knows it's true. And yet nobody believes her. Eventually, they make their way back. All of the children make their way back into Narnia. And they meet up with Mr. and Mrs. Beaver, who are going to be their escorts and take them because Aslan is on the move. And Aslan on the move means that spring is coming to Narnia. And the winter that is forever, but never Christmas is going to come to an end. And but the beavers are deadly afraid because while they're talking about what they're doing, Edmund sneaks out and makes his way toward the evil queen. And the beaver realizes that the queen has a sledge that's pulled by reindeer and can move much faster in the snow than they can walk. And they have to get to the stone table, which is where Aslan is, before the witch gets to them. Because if the witch can get all four children and kill them, that's going to defeat the prophecy. The snow starts melting. There's a sign, signs of spring. There's a bird that helps lead them. Father Christmas comes, which is kind of an interesting, you think it's the witch, but it's really Father Christmas. He gives them all gifts. The gift that Peter got to kill the wolf was a gift that he gave him. He gives Lucy a potion that can heal. But the witch is now coming after them. And when the witch arrives, well, let me get to the story itself, because Lewis tells it better than I do. Now, I'm jumping ahead a little bit to Aslan sent some of the creatures to rescue Edmund, and they whisk him away, get him away from the wicked queen, and he's now with them. And they've all gone to sleep. And when the children woke up the next morning, they'd been sleeping on piles of cushions in the pavilion. The first thing they heard was from Mrs. Beaver that their brother had been rescued and brought into camp late last night and was at that moment with Aslan. As soon as they'd breakfasted, they all went out, and there they saw Aslan and Edmund walking together in the dewy grass apart from the rest of the court. There's no need to tell you, and no one ever heard, what Aslan was saying, but it was a conversation which Edmund never forgot. As the others drew nearer, Aslan turned to meet them, bringing Edmund with him. "Here is your brother," he said. "And there's no need to talk to him about what has passed." It's kind of like what happens after confession, right? It's over. It's gone. It's done. Edmund shook hands with each of the others and said to them in turn, "I'm sorry." And everyone said, "That's all right. That's all right." And everyone wanted very hard to say something which would make it quite clear that they were all friends with him again, something ordinary and natural. And of course, no one could think of anything in the world to say. But before they had time to feel really awkward, one of the leopards approached Aslan and said, "Sire, there's a messenger from the enemy who craves audience." "Let him approach," said Aslan. The leopard went away and soon returned with the witch's dwarf. "What is your message, son of earth?" asked Aslan. "The queen of Narnia and empress of the Lone Islands desires a safe conduct to come and speak with you," said the dwarf, "on a matter which is as much to your advantage as to hers." "Queen of Narnia, indeed," said Mrs. Beaver of all the cheek. "Peace, Beaver," said Aslan. "All names will be restored to their proper owners. In the meantime, we will not dispute about them. Tell your mistress, son of earth, that I grant her safe conduct on condition that she leaves her wand behind her at the great oak." The wand was what she used to turn you into stone. This was agreed to, and the two leopards went back with the dwarf to see that the conditions were properly carried out. "But supposing she turns the two leopards into stone," whispered Lucy to Peter. "I think the same idea had occurred to the leopard themselves. At any rate, as they walked off, their fur was all standing up on their backs, and their tails were bristling like a cat's when it sees a strange dog." "It'll be all right," whispered Peter in reply. "He wouldn't send them if it weren't." A few minutes later, the witch herself walked out onto the top of the hill and came straight across and stood before Aslan. The three children who had not seen her before felt shudders running down their backs at the sight of her face, and there were low growls among all the animals present. And though it was bright sunshine, everyone felt suddenly cold. The only two people present who seemed to be quite at their ease were Aslan and the witch herself. It was the oddest thing to see those two faces, the gold face and the dead white face, so close together. Not that the witch looked Aslan exactly in his eyes. Mrs. Beaver particularly noticed this. "You have a traitor there, Aslan," said the witch. Of course, everyone present knew that she meant Edmund, but Edmund had got past thinking about himself after all he'd been through and after the talk he'd had that morning. He just went on looking at Aslan. It didn't seem to matter what the witch said. "Well," said Aslan, "his offense is not against you." "Have you forgotten the deep magic?" asked the witch. "Well, let's say I have forgotten it," asked Aslan gravely. Tell us of this deep magic." "Tell you?" said the witch, her voice growing suddenly shriller. "Tell you what is written on that very table of stone which stands beside us? Tell you what is written in letters deep as a spear is long on the firestones of the sacred hill? Tell you what is engraved on the scepter of the emperor beyond the sea? You at least know the magic which the emperor put into Narnia at the very beginning. You know that every traitor belongs to me as my lawful prey, and for every treachery, I have the right to a kill." "Oh," said Mrs. Beaver, "so that's how you came to imagine yourself a queen, because you were the emperor's hangman. Now I see. Now I get it." "Peace, Beaver," said Aslan with a very low growl. "And so," continued the witch, "that human creature is mine. His life is forfeit to me. His blood is my property." "Come and take it then," said the bull with the man's head in a great bellowing voice. "Fool," said the witch with a savage smile that was almost a snarl, "do you really think your master can rob me of my rights by mere force? He knows the deep magic better than that. He knows that unless I have blood, as the law says, all Narnia will be overturned and perish in fire and water. Remember when the ear is lopped off, when they're coming around Jesus trying to grab him, and Jesus puts the ear back on?" "It's very true," said Aslan. "I do not deny it." "Oh, Aslan," whispered Susan in the lion's ear, can't we do something about deep magic? Isn't there something we can work against it?" "Work against the emperor's magic?" said Aslan, turning her with something like a frown on his face. And nobody ever made that suggestion again. Edmund was on the other side of Aslan, looking all the time at Aslan's face. He felt a choking feeling and wondered if he ought to say something, but a moment later he felt that he was not expected to do anything except to wait and do what he was told. "Fall back, all of you," said Aslan, "and I will talk to the witch alone." They all obeyed. It was a terrible time, this, waiting and wondering while the lion and the witch talked earnestly together in low voices. Lucy said, "Oh, Edmund," and began to cry. Peter stood with his back to the others, looking out at the distant sea. The beavers stood holding on to each other's paws with their heads bowed. The centaurs stamped uneasily with their hoofs, but everyone became perfectly still in the end, so that you noticed even small sounds, like a bumblebee flying past, or the birds in the forest down below them, or the wind rustling in the leaves. And still the talking between Aslan and the White Witch went on. At last they heard Aslan's voice. "You can all come back," he said. "I've settled the matter. She's renounced the claim on your brother's blood." And all over the hill there was a noise as if everyone had been holding their breath and had now begun breathing again, and then a murmur of talk. The witch was just turning away with a look of fierce joy on her face when she stopped and said, "But how do I know this promise will be kept?" roared Aslan, half rising from his throne. And his great mouth opened wider and wider, and the roar grew louder and louder. And the witch, after staring for a moment with her lips wide apart, picked up her skirts and fairly ran for her life. Chapter 14, The Triumph of the Witch. As soon as the witch had gone, Aslan said, "We must move from this place at once. It will be wanted for other purposes. We shall encamp tonight at the fords of Baruna." Of course, everyone was dying to ask him how he had arranged matters with the witch, but his face was stern, and everyone's ears were still ringing with the sound of his roar, and so nobody dared. After a meal, which was taken in the open air on the hilltop, for the sun had got strong by now and dried the grass, they were busy for a while taking the pavilion down and packing things up. Before 2 o'clock, they were on the march and set off in a northeasterly direction, walking at an easy pace, for they had not far to go. During the first part of the journey, Aslan explained to Peter his plan of campaign. "As soon as she's finished her business in these parts," he said, "the witch and her crew will almost certainly fall back to her house and prepare for a siege. You may or may not be able to cut her off and prevent her from reaching it." He then went on to outline 2 plans of battle, one for fighting the witch and her people in the wood, and another for assaulting her castle. And all the time he was advising Peter how to conduct the operation, saying things like, "You must put your centaurs in such and such a place," or, "You must put scouts to see that she doesn't do so and so," till at last Peter said, but you'll be there yourself, Aslan." "I can give you no promise of that," answered the lion, and he continued giving Peter his instructions. For the last part of the journey, it was Susan and Lucy who saw most of him. He did not talk very much and seemed to them to be very sad. It was still afternoon when they came down to a place where the river valley had widened out and the river was broad and shallow. This was the fords of Baruna, and Aslan gave orders to halt on this side of the river. But Peter said, "Wouldn't it be better to camp on the far side for fear she might try a night attack or anything?" Aslan, who seemed to be thinking about something else, roused himself with a shake of his magnificent mane and said, "Huh? What? What?" And Peter said it all over again. "No," Aslan said in a dull voice as if it didn't matter. "No, she will not make an attack tonight." And then he sighed deeply. But presently he added, "All the same, it was well thought of. That is how a soldier ought to think, but it really doesn't matter." So they proceeded to pitch their camp. Aslan's mood affected everyone that evening. Peter was feeling uncomfortable, too, at the idea of fighting the battle on his own. The news that Aslan might not be there had come as a great shock to him. Supper that evening was a quiet meal. Everyone felt how different it had been last night or even that morning. It was as if the good times, having just begun, were already drawing to an end. This feeling affected Susan so much that she shouldn't get to sleep. And when she went to bed, even when she went to bed. And after that, after she'd lain counting sheep and turning over and over, she heard Lucy give a long sigh and turn over just beside her in the darkness. "Can't you sleep either?" said Susan. "No," said Lucy. "I thought you were asleep." "I say, Susan, what? I have a most horrible feeling as if something were hanging over us. Have you? Because as a matter of fact, so have I." "Something about Aslan," said Lucy. "Either some dreadful thing is going to happen to him or something dreadful that he's going to do." "There's been something wrong with him all afternoon," said Susan. "Lucy, what was that he said about not being with us at the battle? You don't think he could be stealing away and leaving us tonight, do you?" "Where is he now?" said Lucy. "Is he here in the pavilion?" "I don't think so. Susan, let's go outside and have a look around. We might see him." "All right, let's," said Susan. "We might just as well be doing that as lying here awake." Very quietly, the two girls groped their way among the other sleepers and crept out of the tent. The moonlight was bright and everything was quiet, was quite still, except for the noise of the river chattering over the stones. Then Susan suddenly caught Lucy's arm and said, "Look, on the far side of the camping ground, just where the trees began, they saw the lion slowly walking away from them into the wood. Without a word, they both followed him. He led them up the steep slope out of the river valley and then slightly up to the right, apparently by the very same route which they had used that afternoon in coming down from the hill of the stone table. On and on he led them into the dark shadows and out into pale moonlight, getting their feet wet with the heavy dew. He looked somehow different from the Aslan they knew. His tail and his head hanging low, he walked slowly as if he were very, very tired. And then when they were crossing a wide open place where there were no shadows for them to hide in, he stopped and looked around. It was no good trying to run away, so they came toward him. And when they were closer, he said, "Oh, children, children, why are you following me?" "We couldn't sleep," said Lucy, and then felt sure that she need say no more, and that Aslan knew all that they had been thinking. "Please, may we come with you wherever you're going?" asked Susan. "Well," said Aslan, and seemed to be thinking, and then he said, "I should be glad of company tonight. Yes, you may come, if you'll promise to stop when I tell you, and after that, leave me to go on alone." Think of Jesus in the garden with the apostles who couldn't stop from sleeping. They couldn't sleep, and they stayed awake, and they were with him. Jesus was on his own. "Oh, thank you, thank you, and we will," said the two girls. Forward they went again, and one of the girls walked on each side of the lion. But how slowly he walked, and his great royal head drooped so that his nose nearly touched the grass. Presently, he stumbled and gave a low moan. "Aslan, dear Aslan," said Lucy, "what is wrong? Can't you tell us? Are you ill, dear Aslan?" asked Susan. "No," said Aslan, "I'm sad and lonely. Lay your hands on my mane so that I can feel you are there. And let us walk like that." And so the girls did what they would never have dared to do without his permission, but what they had longed to do ever since they first saw him. They buried their cold hands in the beautiful sea of fur and stroked it, and in so doing, walked with him. And presently they saw that they were going with him up the slope of the hill on which the stone table stood. They went up at the side where the trees came furthest up, and when they got to the last tree, it was the one that had some bushes around it, Aslan stopped and said, "Oh, children, children, here you must stop. And whatever happens, don't let yourselves be seen. Farewell." And both girls cried bitterly, though they hardly knew why, and clung to the lion and kissed his mane, his nose, and his paws, his great sad eyes. And then he turned from them and walked out onto the top of the hill, and Lucy and Susan, crouching in the bushes, looked after him, and this is what they saw. A great crowd of people were standing all round the stone table and through the moon, and though the moon was shining, many of them carried torches which burned with evil-looking red flames and black smoke. But such people, ogres with monstrous teeth and wolves and bull-headed men, spirits of evil trees and poisonous plants and other creatures, whom I won't describe because if I did, the grown-ups probably wouldn't let you read this book. Cruels and hags and incubuses, wraiths, horrors, ifrits, sprites, orkneys, wooshes, and etons. In fact, there were all of those who were on the witch's side and whom the wolf had summoned at her command. And right at the middle, standing by the table, was the witch herself. A howl and a gibber of dismay went up from among the creatures when they first saw the great lion pacing toward them, and for a moment, even the witch herself seemed to be struck with fear. Remember when the soldiers all fall down, when Jesus says, "I am"? And then she recovered herself and gave a wild, fierce laugh. "The fool," she cried, "the fool has come, bind him fast." Lucy and Susan held their breaths, waiting for Aslan's roar and his spring upon his enemies, but it never came. Four hags, grinning and leering, yet also at first hanging back and half afraid of what they had to do, approached him. "Bind him, I say," repeated the white witch. The hag's maid darted him and shrieked with triumph when they found that he made no resistance at all. Then others, evil dwarves and apes, rushed in to help them. And between them, they rolled the huge lion over on his back and tied all his four paws together. Shouting and cheering as if they'd done something brave, though had the lion chosen one of his paws, would have seen the death of all of them. But he made no noise, even when the enemies, straining and tugging, pulled the cords so tight they cut into his flesh. And then they began to drag him toward the stone table. "Stop," said the witch. "Let him first be shaved." Another roar of mean laughter went up from her followers as an ogre with a pair of shears came forward and squatted down by Aslan's head. Snip, snip, snip went the shears, and masses of curling gold began to fall to the ground. Then the ogre stood back, and the children, watching from their hiding place, could see the face of Aslan looking all small and different without his mane. The enemies also saw the difference. "Why, he's only a great cat after all," cried one. "Is that what we were afraid of?" said another, and they surged around Aslan, jeering at him, saying things like, "Puss, puss, poor pussy," and "How many nice mice have you caught today, cat? And would you like a saucer of milk, pussums?" "Oh, how can they?" said Lucy, tears streaming down her cheeks. "The brutes, the brutes." For now that the first shock was over, the shorn face of Aslan looked to her braver and more beautiful and more patient than ever.
"Muzzle him," said the witch.
And even now, as they worked about his face, putting on the muzzle, one bite from his jaws would have cost two or three of them their hands, but he never moved. And this seemed to enrage all that rabble. Everyone was at him now. Those who had been afraid to come near him, even after he was bound, began to find their courage. And for a few minutes, the two girls could not even see him, so thickly was he surrounded by the whole crowd of creatures kicking him, hitting him, spitting on him, jeering at him. At last the rabble had had enough of this. They began to drag the bound and muzzled lion to the stone table, some pulling and some pushing. He was so huge that even when they got him there, it took all their efforts to hoist him onto the surface of it. Then there was more tying and tightening of cords. The cowards," sobbed Susan. "Are they still afraid of him even now?" When once Aslan had been tied, and tied so that he was really a mass of cords, on the flat stone, a hush fell on the crowd. Four hags holding four torches stood at the corners of the table. The witch bared her arms as she has bared them the previous night when it had been Edmund instead of Aslan. And then she began to whet her knife. It looked to the children when the gleam of the torchlight fell on it as if the knife were made of stone, not of steel. And it was of a strange and evil shape. At last she drew near. She stood by Aslan's head. Her face was working and twitching with passion, but his looked up at the sky, still quiet, neither angry nor afraid, but sad. And then, just before she gave the blow, she stooped down and said in a quivering voice, "And now, who has won? Fool, did you think that by all this you would save the human traitor? Now I will kill you instead of him, as our pact was, and so the deep magic will be appeased. But when you are dead, what will prevent me from killing him as well? And who will take him out of my hand then? Understand that you have given me Narnia forever. You have lost your own life, and you have not saved his. In that knowledge, despair and die." The children did not see the actual moment of the killing. They couldn't bear to look and had covered their eyes. Chapter 15, Deeper Magic from Before the Dawn of Time. While the two girls still crouched in the bushes with their hands over their faces, they heard the voice of the witch calling out, Now follow me, all of you, and we will set about what remains of this war. It will not take us long to crush the human vermin and the traitors now that the great fool, the great cat, lies dead." At this moment, the children were for a few seconds in very great danger. for with wild cries and a noise of skirling pipes and shrill horns blowing, the whole of that vile rabble came sweeping off the hilltop, down the slope, right past their hiding place. They felt the specters go by them like a cold wind, and they felt the ground shake beneath them under the galloping feet of the minotaurs, and overhead there went a flurry of foul wings and a blackness of vultures and giant bats. At any other time, they would have trembled with fear, but now the sadness and shame and horror of Aslan's death so filled their minds that they hardly thought of it. As soon as the wood was silent again, Susan and Lucy crept out onto the open hilltop. The moon was getting low and thin clouds were passing across her, but still they could see the shape of the lion lying dead in his bonds. Think of the Marys coming to the tomb. And down they both knelt in the wet grass and kissed his cold face and stroked his beautiful fur, what was left of it, and cried till they could cry no more. And then they looked at each other and held each other's hands for mere loneliness and cried again. And then again, we're silent. And at last Lucy said, "I can't bear to look at that horrible muzzle. I wonder, could we take it off?" And so they tried. And after a bit of working at it, for their fingers were cold and it was now the darkest part of the night, they succeeded. And when they saw his face without it, they burst out crying again and kissed it and fondled it and wiped away the blood and the foam as well as they could. And it was all the more lonely and hopeless and horrid than I know how to describe. "I wonder, could we untie him as well?" said Susan presently. But the enemies, out of pure spitefulness, had drawn the cords so tight that the girls could make nothing of the knots. I hope no one who reads this book has been quite as miserable as Susan and Lucy were that night. But if you have been, if you've been up all night and cried till you have no more tears left in you, you will know that there comes in the end a sort of quietness. You feel as if nothing was ever going to happen again. At any rate, that's how it felt to these two. Hours and hours seemed to go by in this dead calm, and they hardly noticed that they were getting colder and colder. But at last, Lucy noticed two other things. One was that the sky on the east side of the hill was a little less dark than it had been an hour ago. And the other was some tiny movement going on in the grass at her feet. At first, she took no interest in this. What did it matter? Nothing mattered now. But at last, she saw that whatever it was had begun to move up the upright stones of the stone table. And now, whatever they were moving about on Aslan's body. She peered closer. They were little gray things. "Ugh," said Susan from the other side of the table. "How beastly. They're hard little mice crawling all over him. Go away, you little beast." And she raised a hand to frighten them away. "Wait," said Lucy, who'd been looking at them more closely still. "Can you see what they're doing?" Both girls bent down and stared. "I do believe," said Susan, "but how queer. They're nibbling away at the cords." "That's what I thought," said Lucy. "I think they're friendly mice. Poor little things. They don't realize he's dead. They think it'll do some good untying him." It was quite definitely lighter now. Each of the girls noticed for the first time the white face of the other. They could see the mice nibbling away, dozens and dozens, even hundreds of little field mice. And at last, one by one, the ropes were all gnawed through. The sky in the east was whitish by now, and the stars were getting fainter, all except one very big one down low on the eastern horizon. They felt colder than they'd been all night. The mice crept away again. The girls cleared away the remains of the gnawed ropes. Aslan looked more like himself without them. Every moment his dead face looked nobler as the light grew and they could see it better. In the wood behind them, a bird gave a chuckling sound. It had been so still for hours and hours that it startled them. And then another bird answered it. And soon there were birds singing all over the place. It was quite definitely early morning now, not late night. I'm so cold, said Lucy. So am I, said Susan. Let's walk about a bit. And they walked to the eastern edge of the hill and looked down. The one big star had almost disappeared. The country all looked dark gray, but beyond, at the very end of the world, the sea showed pale. The sky began to turn red. They walked to and fro more times than they could count between the dead Aslan and the eastern ridge, trying to keep warm, and oh, how tired their legs felt. And then at last, as they stood for a moment looking out toward the sea and Kaer Paravel, which they could now just make out, the red turned to gold. The red turned to gold. The red turned to gold along the line where the sea and the sky met. And very slowly, up came the edge of the sun. At that moment, they heard from behind them a loud noise, a great cracking, deafening noise as if a giant had broken a giant's plate. What's that? Said Lucy, clutching Susan's hand. I feel afraid to turn around, said Susan. Something awful is happening. They're doing something worse to him, said Lucy. Come on. And she turned, pulling Susan round with her. The rising of the sun had made everything look so different. All colors and shadows were changed that for a moment they didn't see the important thing. And then they did. The stone table was broken into two pieces by a great crack that ran down it from end to end. And there was no Aslan. Oh, 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 cried the two girls, rushing back to the table. Oh, it's too bad, sobbed Lucy. They might have left the body alone. Who's done it, cried Susan. What does it mean? Is it more magic?
Yes, said a great voice behind their backs. It is more magic.
And they looked around, and there, shining in the sunrise, larger than they had seen him before, shaking his mane, for it had apparently grown again, stood Aslan himself. Oh, Aslan, cried both the children, staring up at him, almost as much frightened as they were glad. Aren't you dead? And dear Aslan, said Lucy.
Not now,
said Aslan. You're not a, asked Susan in a shaky voice. She couldn't bring to say the word ghost. Aslan stopped his golden head and licked her forehead. The warmth of his breath and a rich snort of smell that seemed to harangue her, to hang around her hair, came all over her.
Do I look like it?
He said. Oh, you're real, you're real. Oh, Aslan, cried Lucy, and both girls flung themselves upon him and covered him with kisses. But what does it all mean? Asked Susan when they were somewhat calmer. It means, said Aslan, that though the witch knew the deep magic, there's a magic deeper still, which she did not know. Her knowledge goes back only to the dawn of time. But if she could have looked a little further back into the stillness and the darkness before time dawned, she would have read there a different incantation. She would have known that when a willing victim who has committed no treachery was killed in a traitor's stead, the table would crack and death itself would start working backward. I'll stop there. The story goes on, but it's a story of triumph at that point forward. And it's a story that, I don't know about you, but I just love reading again and again, over and over. I don't think it detracts at all from Scripture. I think it helps Scripture. We've been looking along the beam instead of at the beam. We've been in Narnia. We've been
living this experience together. This is what Lewis does with imaginative writing. I think he speaks to us, talks to us in ways that we otherwise wouldn't realize or experience. It's compelling. And I think part of the reason he's so popular is that reason, that he speaks to our heart. And it's a story. It's a wonderful story. And it can be understood as a child. It can be understood. Teenagers probably wouldn't read fairy tales. That's why you have to be old enough to read fairy tales again and understand the deeper wisdom, not the wisdom of this world, the deeper wisdom of the true world that Scripture and our time together with Jesus brings to us. So that's my exposition of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. It's really not mine at all. It's Lewis's. And he does a much better job than I do. Next week, if you're still interested in Lewis, we'll talk about The Magician's Nephew. That, in some ways, The Magician's Nephew is my favorite. It's got aspects of astrophysics and wormholes and a fantasy of creation and many worlds and ancient kingdoms and sick mothers and tragedy and betrayal. And it's wonderful. So please come back next time if you want some more Lewis. So questions, comments, observations? Did you enjoy it? Yeah, Diane. Don't you love being read to? I know. Right. Yeah. Yeah. And the warmth and the feel. I mean, when we're hearing the stories, feel like we're getting truth. I mean, we feel like we can just listen and let go and let our minds travel somewhere else. And that's partly why Jesus says your mind needs to be like the mind of a child to understand the truth of Scripture and the wisdom of his story and what heaven is, what being is, where being, heaven is, I think, if God is the great I am, that's what being is. It's his being that creates life in all of us. And if we can, we want to be with him in eternity. Lewis, in his essay, The Weight of Glory, he talks about that. He thinks about, you know, what we think's important in this world. We're going to live forever. What's a few decades? You know, 70 years, 80 years. Maybe you live to 100. That's nothing compared to eternity. And if you sell your soul for a piece of, please eat that Turkish delight. I mean, what have you done? You know, you think about it. I mean, and Edmund becomes, as I mentioned, he turns into something special. It's his sword that cuts the witch's wand in half, because the witch is out there turning all the Narnian creatures into stones so that they can't win the battle. And Aslan's going around turning all the stones back into people. It's interesting, Michael Ward talking about that process of turning you from stone, softening your heart. You know, we talk about stony hearts. Hardened hearts, harden not my heart. These are stones. She turned them into stones. And there's Rumble Muffin there. I forget what his name is. But anyway, he's this friendly giant, and he's a giant stone. And Aslan breathes on his feet, and the warmth gradually moves up his body. And as he moves around, he comes to life again. And Michael Ward says that from that, we can learn that you need to exercise your faith. You can it can be breathed upon you, but for it truly to work, to turn your, to bring you back to life, you need to get in there and do something. You need to be a part of it. It's like this whole idea of looking along the line. You have to exercise. You have to be a part of it. It has to be real to you. You can't just sit there at Mass and then go live your life. I mean, it needs to become a part of you. It's interesting, later in the last battle, Susan, of the three, four Pevensey children, doesn't come back to Narnia again. She marries, she has a family, she has children. They become the focus of her life, and she's no longer open to these spiritual things. And if you remember, she was the one who wondered if Aslan was sneaking away. I mean, her faith was not as strong as Lucy's. I mean, Lucy, the youngest, is just, she more than anyone is the closest to Aslan. Even though Peter's Peter, it's Lucy that is closest to Aslan. And so Susan doesn't go ever up and ever in into heaven the way the others do after the last battle. She's not there. Her faith, you got to live it. You've got to want it. You have to do something about it. And the others sort of talk her out of it, you know. Oh, that can't be. That's miracles. Can't. There's always a reason. We just don't know what it is yet. There's no such thing as a miracle. There's another scene where I think it's Jill Poole. She hasn't met Aslan yet, and she's horribly thirsty. And there's a river, but between the river, which can slake her thirst, there's this lion. But she's really thirsty. And he doesn't seem to be doing anything. And so she starts talking to him, and it's kind of like the woman at the well. You know, what do you want? And I'm thirsty. I want a drink. Well, it's right there. Why don't you go drink? But you're a lion, and you're between me and the water. I'll just go find another way. And Aslan says, there is no other way. He doesn't say, but I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but through me. There is no other way. This is the only way. And it's right there. But we're afraid, or we're distracted, or like the sower and the seed, you know, the rich soil isn't in us for one reason or another. But the river's still there. If he's knocking, all you have to do is open the door. It's there for all of us. I think these are just wonderful stories. Other thoughts? Now, do you want... I thought about, in these presentations, doing, and I'm no scholar, but, you know, sort of the more professorial, talking about all that stuff. But I liked looking along the beam instead of at the beam. But I will, you probably are interested in biographical information about Lewis, so we'll do some of that, because I think that helps reflect on who he was and why he told the stories that he wrote. Not a lot. I had a friend, I think I mentioned last time, give me a cassette that's called Lewis, or tape called Lewis at War, or CDs. And
in that story, there are children who come to live with them. And I don't know if those stories are accurately told or not, but one of them dies as the bombs fall on the city. One goes back to her parents and dies. It was a difficult time. But I don't know if you've seen that what's going on in Asbury, and there are parts of the world where Aslan's on the move in our society, in the darkness that we're experiencing. I think what the St. John Society has brought to this parish, all the young people, when Sue and I first came here, we were the young ones, if you can imagine that. The demographics of the parish were very different than they are today, and it's wonderful. It's wonderful to watch, because this is tomorrow. Soon will be yesterday, but there's hope. Yeah. It was very popular. It was very popular. Lewis kind of didn't. Well, it's not an allegory. He said, this is not about Jesus. This is about Aslan. And this is about the Pevensey children. And this is about the wicked queen. I mean, this is a story. It's a story. So he was evangelizing by saying he wasn't evangelizing. One of the great paradoxes. We have so many of the truths in life are opposites and paradoxes that way. So I don't know. I mean, I guess the answer to your question is some did and some didn't. And the important thing, I think, is if he had written an allegory, those who didn't never would have read it. And that's partly why he used the imaginative literature approach to getting the story out, because it was a way to reach people when their guard's down. When they're just, you're in a story. You know? It's so friendly somehow. And he can get the message across. So, now Tolkien's approach in The Lord of the Rings, he never had the asides. I love the asides that Lewis had. You know, he says, if I had really named it, your parents wouldn't let you hear, you know. If you've ever been really sad. I mean, he has that connection as if he's reading to you. I mean, as you're reading with your eyes, you can almost hear him reading to you as you loved being read to as a child. It was interesting when I was reading this, I was very... Not tonight, but when I was reading it before, it really hit me emotionally about the sacrifice that, I mean, think of it. Think of what God did for us. I mean, just, and we're like Edmund. It's just so powerful, so powerful. Well, thank you all for listening. I think we're approaching the witching hour, not the witch's hour. And if you have time to take a look at, because I'm not planning to read much from The Magician's Nephew next time. Take a look at it, if you like the reading. There's a part that I really love. When Diggory's in between worlds. Oh, that part's magical. Anyway, something to look forward to. We'll see you next Monday. Thank you.